gaze ranging slowly over the long length of him and lingering on his bent head. The light from the hanging lamp shone on his thick brown hair, burnishing it like bronze. She was shaking with a sudden new shyness. But love gave her courage, and she went to him, her bare feet noiseless on the rugs. "Ahmed," she whispered. He lifted his head slowly and looked at her, and the sight of his face sent her on her knees beside him, her hands clutching the breast of his soft shirt. "Ahmed, what is it? You're hurt. You're wounded," she cried, her voice sharp with anxiety. He caught her groping hands and, rising, pulled her gently to her feet. His fingers clenched around hers, looking down at her strangely. Then he turned from her without a word, and wrenching open the flap of the tent, flung it back and stood in the open doorway, staring out into the night. He looked oddly slender and tall, silhouetted against the darkness. A gleam of perplexity swept into her frightened eyes, and one hand went up to her throat, clutching it. "What is it?" she whispered again breathlessly. "It is that we start for Oran tomorrow," he replied. His voice sounded dull and curiously unlike. And with a little start, Diana realized that he was speaking in English. Her eyes closed and she swayed dizzily. "You're sending me away?" she gasped slowly. There was a pause before he answered. "Yes." The curt monosyllable lashed her like a whip. She reeled under it, panting and wild-eyed. "Why?" He did not answer, and the color flamed suddenly into her face. She went closer to him, her breast heaving, trying to speak. But her throat was parched, and her lips shaking so that no words would come. Is it because you're tired of me?" she muttered at last hoarsely. "As you told me you're tired, as you're tired of all those other women." Her voice died away. Again he did not answer, but he winced, and his hands that were hanging at his sides clenched slowly. Diana flung one arm across her face to shut him out from her sight. Her heart was breaking, and she longed with a feeling of sick misery to crawl to his feet, but a remnant of pride held her back. At length he spoke in the same level, toneless voice. "I will take you to the first desert station outside of Oran, where you can join the train. For your own sake, I must not be seen with you, Diana, in Oran, as I am known there. If you should by any chance be recognized or your identity should leak out, you can say that for reasons of your own, you extended your trip, that your message is miscarried, anything that occurs to you. But that's not likely to happen. There are many travelers passing through Oran, Diana. Gaston can do all the business, make all the arrangements for you. He'll take you to Marseille. If you need him, he'll go on to Paris, Cherbourg, London, wherever you wish. And as you know, you can trust him completely. When you don't need him any longer, he'll come back to me. I will not trouble you any longer. You need never be afraid that I'll come into your life again. You can forget these months in the desert and the uncivilized Arab who crossed your path. To keep out of your way is the only amends I can make." She flung up her head. Quick, suspicious, jealousy, love and passion, and truth and pride contending nearly choked her. "Why don't you speak the truth?" she cried wildly. "Why don't you say what you really mean? You're flinging me aside like an old glove. Why don't you say it? Why don't you tell me the truth? Gaston, how many times does he do this a year? Taking me aside and flinging those poor old worn gloves to Marseille, to Paris." Her voice broke into a terrible laugh. He swung around swiftly and flung his arms about her, crushing her to him savagely, forgetting his strength for a moment, his eyes blazing. "Do you think it's easy to let you go? Taunting me like this? Don't you know I've suffered? I'm suffering now. Don't you know that it's tearing my heart out by the roots to send you away? You think I haven't realized what a brute I've been? Oh, what a brute I am, indeed." His arms were like a vice, hurting She clung to him speechlessly, her heart throbbing wildly. He looked down long and deeply into her eyes, and the light in his, the light that she longed for, made her tremble from head to foot. His brown head bent lower and lower, and his lips almost touched her when he drew back. And then the love in his eyes faded again to misery. "I mustn't kiss you," he said huskily as he put her from him gently. "I didn't think I'd have the courage to let you go. If I kissed you, I couldn't go through with it. I didn't mean to touch you." He turned from her with a little gesture of weariness, faint weariness covering him like a soft, easy curtain. And then fear fled back into her eyes. "I don't want to go," she whispered. He paused by the writing table and took up the revolver he'd loaded earlier, raking it absently, spinning the magazine between his forefinger and his thumb, and then replaced it before answering. "You don't understand, Diana. There is no other way. If you really love me, you wouldn't let me go," she cried with a miserable sob. "If I loved you," he echoed with a hard laugh. "Ha! If I loved you! It is because I love you so much that I'm able to do it. If I loved you a little less, I'd let you stay and take your chance." He slowly raised the revolver. And the darkness settled in on the little tent, 10,000 miles from civilization. Racking sobs shook her body from head to foot. She flung out her hands appealingly. "Ahmed, Ahmed, I want to stay. I love you," she panted desperately, for she knew that they were on the edge, the very edge of the abyss. She saw her chance of life and happiness slipping away. He did not move. He did not even look at her. His brows drew together in the dreaded heavy frown of his race. "You don't know what you're saying. You don't know what it would mean," he replied in a voice from which he had forced all expression. And slowly he raised his revolver. The stars twinkled, passion pulsated throughout the entire desert. He raised the blue steel German revolver. And Diana knew then that his determination was unbreakable. All life was slipping away.
But you feel it? You're lost. What are you, nothing but tapioca? Nothing but cream of wheat? Nothing but Ralston?
That's better. The thing to do is to breathe deeply. Look with cold, piercing eyes over the desert sands. Realize that just the other side of the horizon. There it is, all of it. Yes. It was the inverted bowl of night. Once again, quietly flops over and embraces us all. Is anybody with us tonight who is alive? Really? Really? Completely? All pores open, absorbing all those fugitive experiences, those tiny errors of thought, constantly ranging and roving over the vast human intellect. Because each one, time tied in the affairs of men, eventually will unravel us all. Unravel us all. Now, in the consideration of all these things that have come to pass, it behooves us from time to time to look at the mosaic we have caused to come into being. To look at all the colors, the composition, the artistry, the gentle irony, the coloring pool's sardonic comment on our own times. I see 10,000 calendar pictures. Boys with cheeks of tan trudging over the Indiana hillsides with fishing poles and with sunfish. 10,000 girls dressed in what appears to be a coat of paint, briefly and judiciously applied. The garage art of the 20th century, the way of life, the time and place. Yes, the fingers caressed his nut brown hair. His eyes steel, and a tortured look of despair came into the flickered quiet of the room. Is there anybody out there at will? A tortured look of despair, lust, or passion? Or forgiveness, flicker in your right eye, your left eye. Flicker is a completely different story. The split problem of man. I was pulling against that, you know. On one side, you want to be a Boy Scout, and on the other side, there's something completely different. You want to see that other side of me. A short, grayish thing, covered with hair, with long yellowed tusks and kind of watery yellowed eyes, sitting there chewing on what appears to be an old bone and peering out from this clean, honest, reliable, all-American me. Don't you think that of course it is. It's obvious. Quite evident. Just click the coupon. I remember one time this guy next door to us, when I was a kid, he was a reader of Doc Savage. And Doc Savage used to have all these ads in the back pages of the magazine. Do any of you remember Doc Savage? Not one. This is the way of fame. Let me tell you, nobody's going to remember you either, so don't be so smug about it. You had your chance with the plastic and you flubbed it. Lost your nerve at the last minute. And you'd be no better off than Doc Savage. At least I remember Doc Savage. And did I make Doc Savage up? My own mind. Like I invented so many terrible things. Like I invented G.A. who never existed except in my mind.
Did Doc Savage exist or not? Is there anybody out there who knows? Seriously.
Quit shouting, will you?
You can hear them out in the darkness. They're listening to a shout and they go under for the third time. It's terrible. I don't mind it, you know, if they go under quietly, but it's when they start that last third time that bothers me. It's awful. I mean, it's a funny thing. I work here Sunday nights. I'm sealed away from all of the world. Oddly enough, though, when you're sealed away from all the world, your sensitivity to the world is much more acute. Proust, for example, found that out. When he sealed himself into a cork-lined room and began to look at himself and the world that he knew, he began to see everything, began to know everything. He felt every feeling he'd ever felt before, all over again. He was a true Stanislavski method writer. He worked and worked. And that's what happens to me on the Sunday nights. He's sealed away from everything. And the trouble with being here is that you can hear all these shrieks in the darkness. That you don't hear when you're there. You don't hear it at all. It's sealed away here. It's dark. Nothing but endless undulating land on all sides of us and then the sea. And you begin to even believe that Jersey exists. People begin to believe all sorts of things at night. It's always been that way. The little people of Ireland came into being at night. Really. Everything comes into being at night. Everything. Think about it. All that land, all that water, and all those shrieks out there. Oh, you begin to believe everything at night. It's terrible. I believe that the Kohlrabi myth has begun at night. People don't believe in it in daytime. It's only at night that they begin to believe that they've one time seen Kohlrabi and had it when they were a kid. It's ridiculous. Do you know that no adult has ever eaten Kohlrabi? No, no, no. You ask your mother. She'll say, I had it when I was a kid. See? No adult has ever had Kohlrabi, and it's a myth. It's like a racial myth. And eventually, 1,000 years from now, people will begin to carve little watch fobs, little golden watch fobs, and a new idol will be created today. It will be known as the Great Kohlrabi. And people will talk about the time when it existed, but it all came about at night. Not in the daytime, at night. It's at night, you see, and the thing that night does to you, night is truly immutable. It is unchanging. This night, 1957, November, the darkness is just exactly the same as it was 2,000 years ago. Darkness does not change. Light does, not light itself. The things that light illumines changes constantly, but not so the darkness. It's like snow. So all the old fears, all the old magics, all the old pots begin to boil. There's a great layer of magical belief that lies just below the surface of every one of us. And don't think for a minute it's not there. Don't laugh. I'm serious. This is true. But almost every one of us, in one way or another, believes in some kind of magic. We believe that something great is going to happen to us. We use the right toothpaste. This is magic, pure and simple. The magic ingredient in the hair tonic. The magical new car, with the wide, swift fins that will carry you on upwards, 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 through 10,000 asphalt straights of dreams, you in your water. The magic that's just below the surface. Just below the surface. Just below the surface. But it's there. Yes. Tap that hidden source of power just inside of you. Attain mastery over others. Tap those sources of untold powers. Let the gold in you come out. And rise step by step, placing first one foot and then the other on the shoulder blades of your friend and neighbor. And then haul yourself up to the top, placing your one after the other, your coin, until eventually you're at the very peak of the pyramid with the magic formula. Yes. Would you like to be at the top of the pyramid? Of course you would. Of course you would. Send your name and address to Tap the Hidden Sources of Power in Me, WOR New York. You must be over 21. Of sound body, of sound mind. We can't let these secrets fall into the wrong hands, of course. I'll tell them what might happen. And we assume that yours aren't the wrong hands, are they? Of course not. Of course not. So, just begun. Just begun. We'll fling wide open those doorways. Allow your group intellect to prowl on the loose. A giant mastodon of thought. The biggest beast in the jungle. Tromping over all. Attaining mastery. Unspoken mastery. It's you. Have this feeling sometimes that you're going to be a Kodiak bear, 14 feet in height, 27 feet across, 3,000 pounds in weight, sitting down to discuss the problems of the forest with a squirrel. All right, squirrel, let's talk this over, huh? What's the trouble? The squirrel says, well, you see, what we got to do is work out a mutual agreement. We'll carry this forward. We'll bring all good and mutual benefit to the forest. Say, oh, is that right? I see. Mutual benefit, mutual good, eh? I shall retire to my cave. I shall write up a scroll. You shall retire to your tree. You shall write up a scroll, and we shall both appoint committees. And we shall then discuss this further at greater length. We will have a meeting at the summit. Right? Okay. And work it out okay. Shall we? All right. Yes. It was a lovely forest. It's a beautiful forest. It was a forest that had room for squirrels as well as bears. For toadstools, as well as orchids. It's a beautiful forest, all sunny and golden, all dark and soft in the summer. And so we retired to our caves and our trees, and we worked out our scrolls and our graphs. We sent out the emissaries. Something began to happen. Odd things. One thing, this squirrel started to hit the jug. Got to throw his weight around. Started to talk out the side of his mouth. Wise guy, squirrel. Show you what's good for the forest, squirrel. Okay, it's going to be like that, huh? Something like that, eh? Then we had our meeting. top of the squirrel is 48 feet high. Squirrels have no right to be 48 feet high. Just throwing all kinds of monkey wrenches in the machinery here. Now, come on, squirrel. Don't be smart with me. Just because you're 48 feet wide, 48 feet high, have 14 tusks. You get smart with me, I can handle any squirrel, boy. Time and tide in the affairs of men. Time and tide in the affairs of men. Eventually, do just exactly and precisely and conveniently, each in his own way, each in his own time, each in his own undoing, shall we find peace. W.O.R. New York. Said Fagin. What are you doing to me? Come on, get away. Oh, no music! Tolstoy here. I'll be here until 1 o'clock this morning.